Next case is 08-2173, the estate of Jeffrey K. Heintzelman versus Air Experts, Inc.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, my name is Bruce Curry, and I represent the appellant in this action, American Family Insurance Company. I'm joined today at council table by Sean Blatt on behalf of Amicus Curiae, Ohio Association of Civil Trial Attorneys, who I will be sharing time with today. I'd also like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal. This case involves the interpretation of those statutes enacted and modified by House Bill 58. Ultimately, we're asking this court to reverse the Fifth District Court of Appeals decision and reinstate Judge Krieger's opinion granting summary judgment on behalf of American Family. The specific primary issue in this case is whether, pursuant to ORC 272112B, a final judgment and a declaratory judgment action commenced by an insurance company against its insured is to be given binding legal effect upon a judgment creditor in an action commenced under ORC 392906. An analysis of the bill and the particular statute at issue has to start, however, with the Brosby-Weinland case back in 1994. That case involved a fatal automobile accident, and the injured party subsequently brought a personal injury lawsuit against the tortfeasor. While that lawsuit was pending, the tortfeasor's insurance company started a separate declaratory judgment action seeking a no-coverage determination. They did not join in that case the injured party. Ultimately, the court in the declaratory judgment action found there was no coverage, and later the injured party brought a supplementary complaint asking the court for the proceeds or to apply the proceeds of the tortfeasor's policy to satisfy the judgment. The ultimate decision in that case was that the court held that since the injured party was not a party to the supplementary, injured party was not a party to the declaratory judgment, it was not bound thereby, and accordingly it was free to proceed on a supplementary complaint. After that decision, the legislature did two things to supersede the holding of the Bros case, and that was the stated purpose of House Bill 58, was to supersede the effect of the Bros case. First, it amended paragraph A of ORC 272112, and specifically the prior requirement that all persons who have or claim any interest that would be affected must be joined. In its place, it amended paragraph A to say that it is specifically subject to paragraph B, and except as provided in Division B of this section, a declaration shall not prejudice the rights of persons who are not made parties to the action. Paragraph B in the operative language of ORC 272112 simply states, a declaratory judgment or decree that a court of record enters in an action proceeding between an insurer and a holder of a policy of liability insurance shall be deemed to have the binding legal effect described in Division C2 of Section 392906 of the Revised Code. This division applies notwithstanding contrary common law principles of res judicata or adjunct principles of collateral estoppel. 392906 basically indicates that if the holder of a policy commences a declaratory judgment and the court involved enters final judgment with respect to the policy's coverages, the final judgment shall be deemed to have binding legal effect upon the judgment creditor as long as it is entered prior to the judgment being rendered in favor of the judgment creditor against the tortfeasor.
The language of the statute would seem to indicate that this only really applies when the policyholder is the one that files the declaratory judgment. In both Section 272102, it's the policy holder, I believe. And then under 3929.06, it's the policy holder. I wasn't real clear on your argument. Is it that the general declaratory judgment procedure is the one here where the insurer can initiate the declaratory judgment and still have the binding effect under 272112?
That's exactly right, Your Honor. Exactly right. The statute of note, 272112, does not specify that it must be commenced by the policyholder in order to be given that preclusive binding effect that American Family thinks applies here. I would submit to you that's done for a reason. And it also that the legislature specifically looked to the Braz case, and the Braz case was a case where the insurance company commenced the litigation, commenced the declaratory judgment action. The specific purpose or the stated purpose was to supersede that ruling. Now the court did, however, and I think it's very important that when the legislator put in 272112B, it does not say in there that this is only going to apply when it's commenced by the policyholder. It specifically did not make that differentiation, and it's also important to say that the judgment rendered in that action, just simply between the policyholder and the insurance carrier, shall be deemed to have the binding legal effect described in Division C2. The legislature very well could have said that, hey, we're going to require the policyholder to commence this action under 272112, but it didn't. And I would submit to the court that that was done for a reason. One of the tenets of statutory construction is that a court should avoid statutory construction that renders a provision meaningless and inoperative. I would submit to you that in the event that the Fifth District, what the Fifth District held, is it does hold that provision inoperative. There had to have been a purpose that the legislature enacted subsection B of 272112. And if we don't give the preclusive effect to an action commenced by an insurance company, it would make that particular subparagraph superfluous. There'd be no need for it because it would already be covered under 272102 as well as 392906.
And your legislative history relies on the fact that the Braz case was actually identical to this one in that an insurance company brought the declaratory judgment action.
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
So to make a statute only apply to insureds wouldn't effectively even overrule Braz if the only insureds were bound if they brought the action and not insurance companies, if the insurance companies brought the action, which was the Braz fact pattern that they tried to overrule.
Well, I think you're right, and I think that's one of the reasons that the legislature went ahead and also gave that right, if you say, or that ability to their insureds if they were to bring separate suit. So yeah, it cuts both ways in that way, Your Honor.
Are there any other types of declaratory judgment cases where only the party that brings a declaratory judgment action ends up being bound by the decision? Are you aware of any?
Not that I'm aware of off the top of my head.
Isn't the declaratory judgment to determine the rights between the two parties, and that binds both parties?
Absolutely. I just want to touch just for a moment on ORC 1.51, which it was relied upon by the Delaware County Court of Appeals to argue that because the language in 272102 and 392906 is more specific, those statutes should be given effect to the exclusion of 272112. And I think, frankly, the Court of Appeals gave that statute a bit of short thrift on that issue. The language which the Court of Appeals didn't even mention, and I'm not sure why, was that if both statutes can be construed harmoniously, they should be. And in fact, I think it can be. Both of the parties who are parties to the declaratory judgment action have the same right, which is its binding, whether it's in favor of the insurance company or in favor of the insured, and the subsequent party bringing the supplementary complaint is also bound by it.
Let me ask you a different question. In reading one of the briefs, there was an allegation that American Family advised the insured not to respond And then further, he told that there would be no effect from the lack of his response to the case. What should we consider about that?
Well, I think for purposes of our instant issue, nothing. And I only say that because
that doesn't lead to a collusive or fraudulent result in a otherwise litigious situation.
No, I don't. There is no evidence in this record of collusion or allegation of collusion. Matter of fact, it's exactly the contrary. But, Your Honor,
if a carrier asks an insured not to respond, and the allegation in a declaratory is that we don't owe any money in connection with this, and there's no response, a trial court might be likely to just go ahead and grant a default or whatever, which becomes binding on a claimant who isn't even a party to it.
Well, that's absolutely right, Your Honor. However,
that's a good result, you think, for our judicial system?
Not at all.
Every motorist who gets involved in a motor accident becomes a defendant in a case, or before he becomes a defendant, has a declaratory between an insurance carrier and that tortfeasor, and then there's no response, and we get those declaratory judgments, and then there's no case. That's something's wrong with that concept.
Well, it's absolutely a bad result if that happened. Now, obviously, that's not been heard, but it has also set up a separate fraud case, which the insured in this case is currently prosecuted, is currently pending. So what I'm saying is he was not shut out, and obviously they're seeking not only the damages they should have recovered, or rather should have been paid on his behalf in this particular suit, at least pursuant to their theory, but punitive damages and attorney's fees as well. That's Mr. Mardowski, who is an amicus curiae in this case. That case was initially filed a year and a half ago. It was dismissed. It was just refiled approximately a month ago. So ultimately, a fact finder is going to have to determine, did that really happen? I can assure you that is not American Family's version of what happened. But that's an issue of fact which has to be determined in another case with different allegations. That's not a matter that's currently before this court.
I'm trying to leave time for Mr. Blatt. You probably need to leave time for Mr. Blatt now.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Blatt?
Thank you, Your Honor. Sean Blatt on behalf of the Ohio Association of Civil Trial Attorneys. On behalf of the appellant, we urge a reversal of the Court of Appeals decision for the very reason that's been stated here, is that the failure to apply the statute 2721.12 as written fails to enforce or put forth the stated intent of the legislature when it passed all of these provisions. In the stated intent, the intent was to overrule Braz. Braz was essentially a case that was identical in terms of the relevant issues that are before this court. That is, the insurance company filed the litigation, filed the deck action, and solely named the insured as the party. The intent was we want to overrule Braz, supersede Braz, to the extent that judgments, and in terms of what it was quoted, it said, it is the intent of the General Assembly to supersede Braz and its progeny relative to the lack of binding legal effect of a judgment or decree upon certain persons who are not parties to a declaratory judgment action or proceeding. And they went so far as to say that when they amended these statutes, that the potential judgment creditor didn't have standing to commence a deck action itself until it attained a judgment. Likewise, under 392906, it didn't have any right to seek payment, obviously, until it is a judgment creditor. Under subsection C of 392906.
What does the legislation say about the ability to participate in such an action if the injured potential plaintiff learns about it?
A number of courts have ruled that claimant is entitled to permissive intervention. They've said you do not have the ability or standing to commence one.
OK,
But we're going to let
Did the legislature affect that ability to?
I don't believe the legislature necessarily did affect that ability. I think they have the ability to monitor litigation if they have a claim, to identify that and then to seek permissive intervention.
Realize that's not in this case since they
That's correct. That's not in this case.
Yeah.
I see my time is up. I simply wanted to also address quickly the issue of
very quickly
the issue of the problem with this potential fraud issue. There also is any judgment that is taken by way of fraud, you have the ability to seek relief from that fraudulent act. And I believe that was done here. I believe in the underlying case, and that was not awarded. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Blatt. Mr. Cooper.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, I'm here today on behalf of the estate of Jeffrey Heintzelman. With me at council table is Paul Flowers, who I'll be sharing time with and who represents the interests of the Ohio Association for Justice. If I could begin, I'll address Justice O'Donnell's observation that the scheme as appellants propose runs the potential, if not the actual situation in this case, it certainly creates the potential for collusion that can harm the injured party. If the insured has the ability to obtain a declaratory judgment against, or if the insurer has the ability to obtain a declaratory judgment against its insured and convince the insured to walk away from that case.
But you have a remedy for that if collusion occurs, and you, the gentleman in this case, is pursuing that remedy. He has, according to them, filed a separate action. Do you agree that he's filed a separate action?
He has filed a separate action.
And that's a factual dispute in this, in that case, as to whether he did or there was or was not collusion, correct?
That is correct.
And nowhere in the statute before us does it deal with that issue. It simply gives their opinion, both parties, in your opinion, only the insured, the right to file a deck action, be bound by it.
Which we believe, though, Your Honor, is the balance that the legislature struck to take into account the concern that Justice O'Donnell addressed.
But that doesn't make sense when the case that they sought to overrule was not filed by the insured, it was filed by the insurance company.
That's
and
true.
And they specifically overruled us, which certainly by implication would imply that our case is no longer good law.
Well, in the Braz case, this court did say that the injured party is not bound by a declaratory judgment entered into in an action between the insurer and its insured if the injured party was not made party to that declaratory judgment action. To that extent, the legislature has overruled and superseded Braz because the legislation as it exists now says that in certain instances, the injured party will be bound by that declaratory judgment, even if it wasn't a party to that action. And that is when the insured has filed the declaratory judgment action against the insurer.
But why would they use an opposite filing to make that decision? That doesn't make sense.
Well, ultimately, the ruling of this court in Braz was that the injured party is not bound. That was the holding. It's not bound if it didn't participate in the declaratory judgment action. The legislature has said, oh yes, the injured party is going to be bound in this situation. And to that extent, then the legislature did supersede the
Then I'll ask rule. You the same question. Once the declaratory judgment action is filed, our common law principles of deck actions apply. And do you know of any other principle of law that allows only one party to be bound by the decisions in a deck action?
No, Your Honor. However, in the other instances in which you're contemplating, the declaratory judgment statute says that parties with interests need to be joined into that declaratory judgment action. Carved out of that now is the situation that we're in here, which is where the injured party is pursuing the tortfeasor for a claim and then wishes to assert a claim against the insurance company later. So now the insurance companies have no obligation to, even if they're aware of our interest, have no obligation to join us to the declaratory judgment action, contrary to every other declaratory judgment situation.
I guess it's a question of whether you have a right to join or a permissive intervention, because your client has no claim or no standing until they get a judgment against an insured.
Under the statutes as they exist now, that appears to be the case. Certainly, the injured party would always like to participate in that declaratory judgment action to make sure that its interests are adequately represented, because if the insured is pursuing the action, there's no guarantee that the insurer is pursuing the action. There's no guarantee that the insured is going to respond.
So you want us to carve out an exception to declaratory judgment law that finds that in a declaratory judgment action under this situation, only half of the party to the action is bound.
Well,
that's contrary to lots of case law, you understand.
I think what we're asking is simply that this court apply 392906 as it is plainly written. And in doing so, the court won't vary one bit from the legislature's description of what it wants to have happen in these situations. The legislature chose the language for a reason. It knew how to differentiate between declaratory judgment actions brought by the insurance company and declaratory judgment actions brought by the insured. It specifically said that in the instance where the insured has brought that action, then the judgment creditor is going to be bound. I think under the canon expressio unius est exclusio alterius, the expression of that situation by implication excludes the others. So if the judgment creditor is bound in that situation where the insured has commenced the declaratory judgment action against the insurer.
What happens to res judicata and issue preclusions when the legal issues have been ruled upon and decided, and you're now saying that doesn't matter to half of the party in the case?
Well,
that's a fundamental change in basic judgment law.
Well, it will matter, because even if the insured has brought the declaratory judgment action, if the insurer prevails, my client, the judgment creditor, the injured party, is going to be bound. It's simply the case, though, the legislature is simply making sure that if there's going to be a declaratory judgment action that binds the judgment creditor, since the judgment creditor hasn't been permitted to participate in that proceeding, if there's going to be a binding effect, let's make sure it's a case that was brought by the insured, because in that situation, the judgment creditor and the party bringing the action should be rowing in the same direction. Both should be looking for coverage.
Let's ignore the statute for the minute and look at just the general declaratory judgment statute. Would an insurance company have a right to bring a judgment action for a declaration of the rights and responsibilities under an insurance policy?
Yes.
And would that judgment be binding on both parties?
If the judgment creditor has not participated in that action under the statutes, then the judgment creditor is not bound unless it was the insured that commenced that action.
So if you have a judgment, if you have an insured that defaults, no collusion alleged, just doesn't want to bother answering, doesn't do anything, and defaults, there's no consequences to that decision.
No binding effect on the judgment creditor, according to the statutes, according to both 2721.02c and 3929.06c.
So why would anyone ever defend then? If you bring a judgment, declare a judgment action, and they don't show and defend, you don't win. You have gained nothing. You have no declaration of rights under your theory, because it doesn't bind the person that you sued and choose not to defend.
They can bind the judgment creditor by simply naming the judgment creditor and adding them to the declaratory judgment action.
No, I'm saying the insured's not bound. So why would the insured ever show up and defend a DEC action if, under your theory, that declaration will never bind them?
Well, it may bind the insured, but not the judgment creditor.
So they have a declaration that they have no coverage, but the third party can still come in and get coverage, is what you're saying.
If they want to bind the third party, they ought to bring the third party into the lawsuit.
Okay.
That's historically how it's done in declaratory judgment actions. Now, the legislature, again, has made clear where it wants to draw the line, and we believe it's a balancing act. They wanted to bind the judgment creditor in certain situations, and they define those very clearly. Again, in 2721.12, the General Assembly used the language referring to declaratory judgment actions between insureds and insurers. But in 2721.02c and in 3929.06c2, the legislature specifically chose different language, and there has to be a reason for that. And it doesn't violate or contravene the legislative history, because the effect is still that the Braz case is superseded to that extent.
Let me ask you a question about that reference in 2721.12, and I'm a little uncertain, because there's two sections of the code which talk about if the insured commences the proceeding. But in 12, it appears to be more of a general section that if there is a judgment between an insured and an insurer, it still has the effect that is described in C2 of the other section.
So why doesn't this language pull into the general section the preclusive effect that is found separately in two other sections?
I believe it does, Your Honor. And the way it pulls it in is, of course, we have to understand what is the binding legal effect of 3929.06c2. The binding legal effect is that the judgment creditor, the injured party, is bound by a declaratory judgment if that action was commenced by the insured against its insurance company.
So you're reading the preclusive effect to include that qualifier, is that?
Otherwise, it doesn't make sense. That is the binding effect. In this situation, that's the binding effect. Otherwise, the legislature could simply have said in a declaratory judgment action between an insurer and its insured, the results will bind the judgment creditor. I think that section recognizes there are two scenarios, one in which the insurance company has initiated the declaratory judgment action and one in which the insured has. And by making reference to C2, it's recognizing that in that situation, judgment creditor is going to be bound. And with that, Your Honors, I will cede my remaining time to Mr. Flowers.
Thank you, Mr. Cooper. Mr. Flowers.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'm Paul Flowers. I'm the amicus curiae chairman for the Ohio Association for Justice. Mr. Cooper said everything exactly right, and we certainly agree with him. I think that the point I'd like to stress is that the real harm we're facing here, the real danger, is not the situation where the insurer calls up the insured and says, hey, don't worry about this deck action, we'll take care of it, just let it ride its course. You know, maybe that happened here, maybe it didn't. The real harm is these situations where the default is entered because the insured is insolvent, the insured is out of business, the insured doesn't care. Any of those situations like we have here where we wind up with a default judgment after just 3 months of litigating the declaratory judgment action, and now the plaintiff, the judgment creditor, is stuck with that. That's the real problem. And I think when the General Assembly, not once but twice, in both 2721.02c and 3929.06c2, referred to the policyholder bringing the claim, they were eliminating that situation. If we give preclusive effect only to the policy, only when the policyholder brings the claim against the insured, the policyholder obviously has the finances and the motivation and the wherewithal to litigate the declaratory judgment action. And I think the assumption is if the policyholder litigates this fully, then there's no harm in binding the judgment creditor to
that. So you believe that Braz is still good law?
To an extent.
Because Braz involved an insurance company at almost identical fact pattern here.
Right.
And so what did the legislature intend to overrule by saying we're intending to overrule Braz? How did it overrule Braz if Braz, in your opinion, is still good law?
They overruled it to the extent that Braz suggests that when the policyholder brings the claim, the declaratory judgment action against the insured, that will be binding on everyone. To the extent Braz says that that's not the case, the legislature is saying it is. Now, you had asked the question previously about, you know, they're intending to overrule Braz, and this is a Braz case, so we should assume that they meant a different result here. And I think that's dangerous, because when we talk about what the General Assembly intended, we're engaging in a certain amount of speculation. And the language, the uncodified language about Braz, all it says is we're putting binding effect in certain circumstances. There's no language that says Braz is completely overridden. And so it's always safest when this court, any court, relies on the specific terms of the statute. And here they refer to the policyholder bringing the claim twice. And when we just stick to the terms of the statute, that is the best way of ensuring that we're furthering legislative intent and we're providing stability in the justice system. And that's what we have here. We avoid this whole situation where we're going to have default judgments binding people who were never parties to the declaratory judgment action. We avoid all the constitutional issues of due process and equal protection that arise from that if we just interpret these three statutes the same way that the Fifth District did. And the Fifth District's decision makes perfect sense. It gives a cohesive, common sense construction to these three statutes, and it avoids this situation where we take a default judgment against a rural electrical company for which whatever reasons did not defend the declaratory judgment action. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Flowers. Mr. Curry, you've used your time, which may take 30 seconds.
Yes, Your Honor. I just wanted to respond to opposing counsel's argument, there had to be a difference for changing the language in 27-2102 and 36-3906. And I think there is. I think the legislator wanted to make sure it was crystal clear that this wasn't a right that they were actually only giving to the insurance companies in 27-2112. So they went out of their way to say in the other two statutes, if in the event when the insured commences the lawsuit, we're going to give that effect as well.
How do you deal with the argument then? I mean, take out fraud and collusion, which is a determination for another court and another day here. But there is sometimes no incentive for insureds who are insolvent or out of business or otherwise to maybe defend. And basically, the person injured gets stuck holding the bag for something that may be very defensible. How do you deal with that public policy argument in the interpretation that they seek?
Well, it is a very tough argument. I'll concede that point. I think, however, that it assumes, one, that a defendant insured in a declaratory judgment action is not going to act with self-interest in mind. I also think that it assumes that the judge or fact finder hearing the case below is going to get this decision wrong. As a practical matter, however, Your Honor, and I concede the point, if the insured does not want to respond to it, there's not a whole lot that can be done.
I know in a conflict of interest case, the insurance company has a duty to appoint separate counsel. Is it a deck action? Does the insurance company still have a duty to appoint separate counsel for the client to defend the deck action, or is the client totally on their own?
I'm aware of no decision that holds to that effect. I don't believe there's any obligation to do so on behalf of the carrier.
Okay, so if you have a conflict, you give them a counsel, but if you're saying you don't have any coverage at all and you bring a deck action, they're on their own.
I think that's correct, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Curry.
Thank you.
Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.